indicates our calendar is 9985, Richard Seagrove, suspended the clock message. Justice President has recused herself in this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in the place of Justice President Robert Nader, Certificate of the Court of Appeals from the 11th District. Mr. Garza.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I can. May it please the court and counsel. This case involves two issues. The first issue was a jurisdictional issue. In simplest terms, did the trial court have or not have jurisdiction to decide the constitutionality challenges?
I know you say you didn't raise it in your original complaint, but wouldn't it be fair to say your original complaint implicitly, if not explicitly, raises the constitutionality of Senate Bill 20? Is that what this case was going to be all about? And should you have served the Attorney General then?
No, not at the time of the original complaint. When we originally filed the complaint, we sued the tortfeasor Benjamin Sock Master. At that time, we didn't know what his insurance coverage was. We didn't know if there was an underinsured motorist coverage question or not. We didn't know what his liability was.
You filed the suit before you ever got a copy of the policy pursuant to the rule?
We filed a lawsuit just against the tortfeasor, seeking to recover from the tortfeasor.
But didn't you get a copy of his policy before you filed the suit?
No.
It's discovered.
The tortfeasor? No.
They wouldn't give you that because it's discoverable.
Yes, but we didn't have a copy of the Range's insurance policy, the liability policy, before we filed the suit.
Well, you make that sound so strange, like it's a crazy question. And after the rule was passed, we used to get those policies before suit to prevent suit sometimes.
I have very seldom had a liability carrier give me a policy. So with respect to the first, and the court has to understand, this was an evolving process. We filed a lawsuit against the tortfeasor. We find out what the insurance coverage is. We amend the complaint the first time to add the colonial with the underinsured motorist carrier. Then we realize about the issue with respect to the amount of the tortfeasor's coverage. And that's when we amend the complaint the second time. At the time we amended the second complaint, or at least filed for the commission, we had the motion for summary judgment prepared.
Obviously, you have the policy, and both of those complaint, you still did not challenge the constitutionality of the statute.
We didn't specifically put it in the complaint. We asked for declaratory judgment as to the party's rights.
All right, when you do that, how does that become of interest to the Attorney General?
It doesn't.
The Attorney General, the Attorney General never had notice of your challenge until the Court of Appeals.
I respectfully disagree with that.
Well, that's my question I'm asking.
You didn't
raise the issue.
We didn't raise the issue specifically in a separate paragraph in the Second Amendment complaint. What we did was we took the memorandum in support of summary judgment, set forth the various constitutional challenges, and set that to the Attorney General.
In your summary judgment exercise, not in your amended complaint.
That's correct. That's right. We sent that to the Attorney General because that would be done to them to give the Attorney General notice of the constitutional challenges specifically delineated them to set forth the arguments. We thought that was the best notice under the circumstances with respect to this particular situation.
Notice was sent general mail to the Attorney General's office, not directed to any person or department. It was 14 days, on summary judgment, had 14 days in which to respond. Isn't that correct?
We sent that, that is correct, we sent it by U.S. mail. There was a special procedure, local rules that your county follows. And in fact, after the court might remember that I was adding Graves as a party at the time, even though I filed a summary judgment motion. And the trial court held a subsequent case management conference, if you will. I believe it was in December or January, whenever Graves entered an appearance, and we set up a new schedule for briefing to give them adequate time to respond.
Should we, this case seems to me as important, I didn't vote to bring it in, but now this issue seems to me more important than I thought. It looks to me as if we need, the court needs to make some statement about what is required in notifying the Attorney General, both in terms of the time of notification and the manner of notification, so that everybody, all lawyers know exactly how you do it. It's not that difficult, it seems to me, to provide notice to the Attorney General in a manner that is reasonably designed to give that office adequate notice to make an appearance. And, as you know, there's case law that says the appearance should be in the trial court, of course, that's ideal. What is your thought about that? Do you think it should be, we should just do this case by case, or?
It doesn't say that. It just says serve with notice of the proceedings, right?
That's
okay.
Correct.
I mean, we might as well talk about the words it uses, right?
I agree. Okay.
Yeah.
And we tried to do that. We didn't, where I feel we have a problem is, I mean, we can't control what the Attorney General does. And if she comes in the trial court or the appellate court, and quite frankly, since this issue's come up in any other case, I've amended the complaint that named the Attorney General party and served her by the regular means so I can obviously reach the merits of the position we're advocating, because that's what we want to do. So perhaps it would be a good idea to simply set some simple rule as to how this should be done. So we don't fall into this problem again. The other thing I would like to point out, and decide cases on their merits, I mean, shouldn't there be some requirement when you're at the trial court level to make some complaint, and maybe a sign that that rule be looked at again? I mean, the other side, can't they object to this and not wait until we get on appeal before they first break?
Well, the bad news is that you can raise jurisdictional issues any time.
That is the general rule. That's
yeah.
what I said. I
yeah.
threw out the fact that perhaps it was time to look at that again as to whether or not that is really a fair rule. When you get involved in circumstances such as this, the other thing I would like to address, however briefly, with respect to this issue is, Attorney General appearing before the Court of Appeals mean, or what effect should that have in this situation? And in that regard, I'd like just simply to point out to the Court that we served a copy of our appellant's brief upon the Attorney General by regular U.S. mail, addressed to Betty Montgomery, exactly the same way we've done the motion for summary judgment, the memorandum for summary judgment. And if U.S. mail is so unreliable, how does that reach them the second time and not the first? But the Attorney General did come in and did state, pursuant to ORC 2721.12, we received notice of a constitutional challenge. Now, I have to tell you, when I first saw that, I just assumed that they were referring to the summary judgment that we sent out earlier, and I really didn't see this as being any great issue. I mean, they were just simply, however, belatedly confirming that they had received a notice of the proceedings. Argue that when the Attorney General comes in and makes that statement, that should cure any problem with respect to this issue. And I would just simply, by analogy,
that does. I think the argument there is that the statute goes on to say shall be heard. You know, the second phrase shall be heard might be the importance of that might be that not serving at the trial level but only on appeal, then shall be heard is made meaningless.
Well, also remember in this case that the Attorney General said she didn't want to participate in
But that's having been heard. I guess I would say when someone says don't want to participate, that is having
that
been
is
heard.
Saying that we don't want to be heard.
Yeah. So you were heard. You were heard to the extent that you said, I don't want to be a part of it. But.
That's true. I'll just briefly turn, unless some other members of the court has some additional questions on the jurisdictional questions.
One of the Attorney General's form response to the nature of a special appearance declared it didn't want to be take part as a party in the case.
Correct. They said they didn't.
And then
if I then
continue that along to the actions against that opinion in there, I would equate that to a waiver of service so that in that opinion, they say if he does then participate or she does then participate in the action, in a representative position, they have then made service, in effect, is deemed to have been served. But that's like making a special appearance, and then if you don't go any further, you're not in there to contest the constitutionality. But if you then participate, which seems to be an option in the statute, the Attorney General then by participating, has in effect waived the service. And again, then you can proceed on the constitutional question. don't directly relate that to your position, but that's sort of the way I'm looking at it.
That the words serve, you know, shall serve a copy of the proceedings requires, I mean, I think for your argument to win, it has to be certified mail or proof of receipt or something more than here we have some of the other party doing a proof of service.
Your Honor, I agree with you. It has to be something more than what we argue in our brief and page 13. Tossing a non or unfiled stamped motion in the mail and sending it by ordinary mail service to the Attorney General.
Right, but I mean, where does it say it has to be different than that?
Well, it requires service.
Well, yeah, and service is defined, but we, here there was a proof of service, wasn't there?
There
they
was
certified, they certified that they mailed this to the Attorney General. That's what we call proof of service. And
a certificate of service indicating by ordinary mail they mailed an unfiled motion for summary judgment to the Attorney General.
I know, and I understand, I empathize with your view that that doesn't seem good enough, but I'm looking to what part of the rule says it's got to be more. The word serve is there. But it says serve, it doesn't say serve the complaint. You know, we know that the civil rules tell us how a complaint must be served. I'm struggling to find how we can, how that's a violation.
Your Honor, I think service implies that you file a press kit with the court. You ask the clerk of courts to serve a copy of the complaint or proceeding against the opposing counsel or the new party that's been involved in the case. Something to put.
Because we do distinguish service by certified mail or ordinary mail service. You know, in the civil rules, we do distinguish for various at various times in various levels of proceeding between certified mail service and then ordinary mail service.
The Attorney General is a very interesting party.
It seems that it ought to be certified. I don't disagree with you, but I'm not sure where it says that.
Well, right now, I believe that the service requirement requires putting the Attorney General, in this case, on actual notice of the proceeding, not filing, but sending a non-stamped or unstamped motion to the Attorney General without any specific identity of the section chief or anything. And the amicus brief filed by the Attorney General, they indicate, although this is not proper, they indicate
right.
They never got the motion.
But you see what I'm looking for is your reason, your support in the rule, in the language. I mean, it sounds great, but where does it say that?
And I think I agree with Chief Justice Ware, who says that maybe this case is one that should give direction
yep.
to the lawyers in terms of how to deal with issues, specifically with the putting of the aging on notice of
yeah.
constitutional attacks.
It's hard to say that this, what was done here, violates the language of the statute.
I think it's easy to argue that it does violate the statute because there's first of all, the Attorney General indicates that they have no evidence whatsoever that they got service.
It doesn't say receipt. It says mail.
But Your Honor, I think service implies something more than sticking something in the mail.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the best argument, that there's an implication. You see what I mean? We're looking for...
Counsel, doesn't the rule provide that you can choose to service only apply after your initial service? Once you got an attorney or a party to serve, you can just mail a copy about any reason to do it. That does not substitute for the original service. I think you have to draw an analogy to the original service. You don't have an attorney of record.
Certainly after the party has entered an appearance, certificate of service completed the closing house and certainly.
And was there ever service done by ordinance to the court or was it only by
the state? Or by certificate of service docket. As part of the record, the trial court docket doesn't reflect that there was any attempt to mail anything to the AG's office.
We might have a different argument if you try for it.
Through the court, you have a better argument, and the opposing counsel has a much better argument. The idea is to give the Attorney General actual notice and give them an opportunity to be heard and have the due process work, and in this case, it didn't work because. There was no effort on the part of the plaintiff's counsel to put the AG on notice. And as a result, the AG did not even know about this case until the Court of Appeals was open. At that point, the trial court never had jurisdiction. And as a result, the Court of Appeals, in its unanimous decision, properly ruled that the trial court never had jurisdiction over Betty Montgomery. And as a result, they can't rule on the constitutionality issues.
Should the trial court, if it knows that the Attorney General has been served, I guess even to the summary judgment stage, since the statute says the Attorney General shall be heard, should the trial court hold up the proceedings and just suggest that the trial court doesn't have any jurisdiction until the Attorney General makes an appearance, whether to say I want to be here or I don't want to be here? Is that what the trial court should have done here?
I dare say that Judge McKenzie didn't even know that opposing counsel made an attempt to mail a motion for summary judgment to Betty Montgomery's office. I mean, I'm just speculating here, of course, but I can't imagine that Judge Earl McKenzie would be sitting in his office with the trial court record pleadings and the docket sheet and all that stuff thinking, geez, I wonder if the Ohio Attorney General got served, particularly given the fact that Chief Justice Stratton raised the point that there was nothing filed in a court reports office to indicate that even ordinary service was attempted. So, as a result, I don't think the trial court has any responsibility to do the work that the closing out in this case was supposed to do. And I think my time is probably getting late, so I will defer to Mr. Schuller to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Thank you, Mr. Schuller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Shuler. Is it fair to say that if we rule on that issue in Appley's favor, we never get to your issues? The what? Separate concurrence in that case, wasn't there?
There's a separate concurrence.
Saying I only rule on the one subject rule?
Justice Piper ruled on the one subject rule, yes, correct.
So the we may be generic, not necessarily inclusive.
Well, that's the question. What does the court in the legal decision tend to hold as a matter of precedent? That the issue is resolved and sent to what is unconstitutional? That the three silent dissents, coupled with Justice Piper's opinion, abstaining from ruling on 4 out of 5 constitutional challenges, left the matter open and in effect unanswered? Did the court accept referral from a federal court and then fail its court to answer it? If this court did not intend the legal decision to serve as precedent for the constitutionality of Section 20, it has, in fact, seized virtually every district court of appeals in Ohio and nearly every common pleas court. Decision after decision, and the dozens of them, have all held interpreted the legal decision as holding Senate Bill 20 constitutional. This has created an unusual phenomenon in the area of automobile litigation in recent years, phenomenon of stability. This court is being asked, in fact, this is appeal to tell all of the appellate courts of the state that they all went to be wrong. To tell the insurance companies, the general public, who have based their business as usual on these appellate interpretations, that they, that their, these interpretations are erroneous. I think a commitment by this court to the principle of stare decisis, to the promotion of bad indivisibility in Sarah Cusco's back in the 80s, would be a good reason to affirm the Sixth District Court of Appeals. But there's a better reason. Senate Bill 20 statutes simply do not violate the provision of the Ohio Constitution. The right to a remedy clause is not violated because insurance coverage is not a remedy. Senate Bill 20 does not limit an insured party's right to recover judgment against the tortfeasor. Limitation of insurance benefits is not a violation of the Constitution, nor is there any right to insurance in the state. There is no violation of separation of powers here because the legislature is the final arbiter of public policy, unless it acts, to contravene the state or federal constitutions. The rulings in Savoy, Wood v. Shepherd, Schaefer v. Allstate were not constitutional mandates to the legislature, since they were not decided on a constitutional basis, on the basis of statutory construction. And the statute involved was a different statute. There is no violation of the Equal Protection Clause because Senate Bill 20 treats persons who are similarly situated the same. This is true of both liability and uninsured motorist provisions in the bill.
We need to sum up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't notice.
We need to make that life brighter, I guess.
As may I have a few sentences?
Just a 30 seconds.
Justice Cook's analysis, the legal decision of these various